This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, welcome to Reeling Southeast Asia, bringing you on a journey to discover Southeast Asian cinema. This week, we'll be talking about Thai cinema, old and new. First up, we talk to Aditya Asara, a filmmaker and producer. So, in a review of your feature film, Wonderful Town, Tony Raines, in Sight and Sound, calls you a psychogeographer. And I want to follow up on this apt reading of your film. And actually, not just that film, but, you know, your other short film, too. Because I think it really describes a sensibility that comes through also in the choices of films that you help produce. And I'm thinking about 36 and P047, directed by Kong Dej.
Well, actually, I should make a correction. I didn't actually produce P047.
Okay.
It's produced by my partner at the company, but I actually did not have a direct role in the film.
Oh, okay, okay. So, I mean, by psychogeography, Raines is referring to this New York writer, Will Self's notion of how the environment really affects characters and people in your film. Can you say something about, you know, how psychogeography really affects your filmmaking and then also the kinds of films that you choose to support or produce?
Well, I mean, psychogeography, I guess, is one way to put it. I never heard of that word before, but I think basically that the same way of saying it is just that I'm interested in architecture.
Mm-hmm.
It's something that I've been interested in a long time. I think that if I didn't become a film director, I think I would have actually enjoyed being an architect.
But your first degree was not in film, right? You did your master's in film.
No, actually, I have a degree in history.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, also, I think it also has to do with the circumstances of producing independent films, because, you know, the thing that really is most important is that we don't have a lot of budget.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you don't have a lot of budget, there's very few things that are actually in your control.
Mm-hmm.
And the two main things, one is actors and the other one is location, because these are the two things that you can really have control over without needing a lot of money. And
mm-hmm.
The two of them are actually quite similar. You know, the same way that you would cast an actor, you know, based on their aura or their the way they look or the way they say a line.
Mm-hmm.
Every actor comes across a certain way. Like every actor has a certain, let's say, flavor. And I look at location in the same way, that every time you walk into a different space, like a building or a natural space, it has a certain flavor that is not unlike anything else. And so I think that, you know, with actors and with location, with low-budget film, these are the two main things that you can play around with. And so even way back from the beginning when I first started making films and I didn't have much money,
mm-hmm.
Those are always the two things that I look for first. And so I think that that always remained in my films.
But why are you drawn to rubble? To ruins. I'm thinking about your short film Bangkok Blue, or your segment Sawasdee Bangkok, and it seems like there's it's not just coincidence, right? That in that film you have Ananda Everingham's character, and he's like a sound recorder.
Oh yeah.
You know, and then
I guess, you know, you're looking for, you know, an answer. Like you're looking for a way for me to explain it.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not sure that I can logically explain it. I think that I would be more comfortable saying that I just like it. It's sort of mm-hmm. like a personal preference, you know, the same way that, you know, I would like, let's say, a certain kind of food, but I can't really tell you why I like that food. I mean, I guess it just looks nice to me.
But you know, is this aesthetics also tied to your experience or your background as a student of history? Because memory, history, I mean, those are kinds of themes that seem to come up.
Oh no, not really. I wouldn't say that it's something that I've, you know, intellectualized. I mean, I don't think that I've intellectualized such a thing in my film. I think that I simply prefer it. It's simply a personal preference. I mean, I suppose when I walk into certain places or certain buildings, I just get a feeling that I like it, and you know, I would like to shoot something there. You know, it seems like it would be an interesting space for something to happen. But then, having said that, I guess if I I mean, now that I'm answering the question, I am starting to intellectualize it. I suppose that, you know, I guess some of my films have been about, you know, especially with Wonderful Town, you know, it's mm-hmm. about a love affair that doesn't really work out. And I think that, you know, having a love affair that doesn't work out, you know, in a space that is full of rubble, I guess the two things sort of echo each other.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose if I had to intellectualize it, you know, it might be something along those lines.
Yeah, I mean, these, of course, as filmmakers or, you know, as creative people, you do things that sort of by instinct, and it's only in retrospect that you kind of think through things
yeah,
more
exactly.
critically. And these themes do come together a lot, you know, because in Bangkok Blues, the woman sees the card "Memory Lives Forever" sticking out of Ananda's bag, you know, as she's listening to the sound that he recorded of a playground in New York. You know, there's sort of children
right.
laughing and
right,
it's
right.
and it's life, but
right.
but the camera takes us, the viewers, not so much her as she's sitting there listening to the sound. The camera takes us as it pans around her almost 360 degrees, and we see the rubble.
Oh, that's right.
Right,
yeah.
The playground is ruined. And then, and you hear the sound of life juxtaposed over the sort of
right,
death
right, right.
or
yeah,
ending.
Yeah, that's true. I forgot about that.
But now, then, I just want to make this connection, and I'm not sure if it's by coincidence. Of course, in 36 in Nawalpur, the most, you know, striking images that come to us would be this couple, a location scout. She's a location scout, and this time he's an art director, and they're in this location, which is again among the rubble.
Yeah.
Were you
Yeah, I mean, I suppose so. I mean, but I guess I would say, you know, a similar thing, because I know, you know, being the producer of the film, I know that the circumstances that we had to make the film is that, you know, he didn't have a lot of money. And so I think that he approached it in the same way, you know. You sort of end up conceptualizing the project and writing the script around the budget, mm-hmm. not the other way around. And so having so little money, I think that he chose a concept where he knew that he only needed 36 shots. So it wouldn't require a lot of time to shoot.
But he chose a rubble, though. He chose the old Love Hotel or something.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I guess maybe it's also a process of watching, you know, like the recent Thai films, which I guess I'm responsible for some of them, and they're all in the rubble. And I guess, in a way, maybe it's also personal preference, you know, his own personal preference, which I think maybe somewhat similar to mine, and that's why we sort of, you know, ended up being producer and director, because, you know, we sort of end up having similar ideas about the same films.
You have an obsession with memory. You use digital devices, sound recorders, digital cameras, as what Bernard Stiegler calls, I know, hypomnesic devices, basically, you know, devices that store our memory or do that for us.
Yeah.
But there are problems with this, right? There are disadvantages to storing our memory
mm-hmm.
on a digital. Do you want to say something about 36 and also the next film that you're helping to produce by Nawalpur?
I guess so. I mean, I suppose, you know, I mean, I guess that's what, you know, film is really good for, is to record memories, you know, record things that you saw and you felt at a certain time. I mean, I suppose, you know, way back from the beginning of when the technology was created, you know,
mm-hmm.
the thing that it was great in doing was recording things. You know, it's sort of like, branching off from photography, which I suppose is the same thing as recording things. I guess also for me, you know, the feeling of melancholy is something that I enjoy a lot in books and in other movies. And so, you know, for my own films, you know, it's mm-hmm. a feeling that I always try to capture. I think that that's one thing that is in every one of my films. People always remark that they have a certain melancholy. And I think melancholy is very closely related to memory. It's sort of trying to recall like a certain time that's passed already. And I guess that feeling of not really being able to fully, you know, hold on to something that's already passed is something that means a lot to me. And I guess that's, you know, wound up in my films one way or the other. The new film that I'm producing that's directed by Nawalpur is a movie called Mary is Happy. It's actually Mary is Happy, Mary is Happy. that we're taking a little bit different approach. I mean, I think that Nawapol is in some sense, he's a different filmmaker than I am. Mm-hmm. I think that I work very much with the way I feel and my instincts, but I think that Nawapol is more like an artist. I think he works from concepts. And, you know, his idea for 36 was that he wanted to make a film that's based around 36 shots. Mm-hmm. It begins with a concept.
Yeah.
That's not really the way I work. I mean, I guess I would say I'm more traditional. I mean, I just work from stories I want to tell or certain mm-hmm. feelings I want to capture. I would say it's a more traditional way of working.
Mm-hmm.
But Nawapol is, I guess in a way, he's more similar to Joe, to Api Chatfield, mm-hmm. in that he works from certain artistic concepts that he wants to prove.
Mm-hmm.
And so with 36, you know, he wanted to prove, like, can I make a film with only 36 shots?
Yeah.
And for this new film, it's the same thing. He started with a concept that, you know, I want to adapt, you know, a girl's Twitter feed into a film.
Yeah.
Can I do that? You know, it's a certain challenge.
Because they're so short.
Yeah, and so you know, we took an anonymous girl's Twitter feed that he didn't know,
mm-hmm.
and he chose a certain portion of the Twitter feed. It's about 400 tweets, and they're consecutive, and he set himself a certain amount of rules.
Yeah.
The first rule being that he would not skip any tweets. The second one was that he could not rearrange the order of the tweets.
Uh-huh.
And the third, that is, that each tweet would equal one scene in the film. And then that was the concept that he set for himself.
Wow.
And then the process of making the film is really the process of proving whether or not it can be made into a film. And, you know, having now finished the film, I think that, you know, he's succeeded really remarkably. I mean, I think that it's really a remarkable film.
Wow.
I'm very excited for the film, and it's a movie that I'm very proud to be associated with.
Now tell me the title again, because I thought it was called The Year of June.
No, we changed the name of the thing. It's called. It used to be called that, but mm-hmm. now it's called Mary is Happy.
Mary is Happy. Is that one of the tweets?
No, not really. But it's actually called. The actual title is doubled up. It's Mary is Happy. Mary is Happy.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, is there a way for Malaysians to access these wonderful films?
To see our film?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, there's always DVDs floating around, but in terms of, you know, like, you know, actual festivals, I mean, you guys don't have a festival.
Oh, ouch, ouch, yeah, we don't.
We're supposed to have a festival, but that didn't work out. So, I mean, I guess in a way, you know, I mean, it's sad to say, but no, you don't really, there is no real sort of, I would say, official way for Malaysians to screen the film. I mean, besides knowing somebody who knows somebody who has a DVD.
Yeah, or going to the Thai Film Festival or something.
Yeah, I mean, in the future, I mean, we need to build some kind of system where, you know, you can view it online, you know.
Yeah.
That's always the way it's going to work in the future. But in terms of, you know, the traditional way of selling the rights of the film to a Malaysian distributor, it's not going to happen for these kind of films because there's not a big enough audience to watch it. And then so, you know, that's not going to work.
Yeah.
So I think that right now we're in sort of a time when it's neither here nor there. Like, we've already proven that, you know, our films, they don't survive in the cinema.
Yeah.
But yet we're not at the point when there's an online infrastructure that's going to support, you know, the viewing online.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think that it'll take some time.
I guess one of the ways to access these films or DVD is through Amazon, but sometimes in Malaysia, Amazon doesn't ship to Malaysia, unfortunately. We're known for credit card fraud.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it doesn't work. I mean, you know, like I said, I mean, you know, you can buy Wonderful Town DVDs mm-hmm. through Amazon, but
that's right.
I mean, nobody's going to do that. I mean, it's just too much of a pain in the butt, and it's too expensive.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that the existing sort of infrastructure, it doesn't work for your average Malaysian guy who wants to watch Wonderful mm-hmm. Town. I mean, I think you need a better system than that. You know, now, I mean, we live in a time when nobody's going to pay for DVD. People are just going to download it for free. And so, you know, I'm sure Wonderful Town, you can download it off somewhere for free. But, you know, we need to come to a point where there's, you know, like a way for it to be done above ground where it's not so expensive.
Yeah. Thanks a lot for this interview and
for
those insights, and do let us know when the film comes out. I'm sure we'll hear about it at the film festival since last year
it's
been doing so well.
It will be in Venice. It's in the Venice Film Festival.
Venice Film Festival.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then after that, it will be in Busan.
In Busan. Okay, that's great. That's closer.
Okay.
Okay. That was Aditya Asara explaining about his experience producing films. And after the break, we'll talk to Mary Ainsley from the University of Nottingham, Malaysia, about Thai cinema history. Right here on Reeling Southeast Asia, BFM 89.9. FM 89.9, this is Reeling Southeast Asia, bringing you on a journey to discover Southeast Asian cinema. We're exploring Thai films this week, and we've just talked to Aditya Asara, a filmmaker and producer. Next up, I talked to Mary Ainsley, who's an expert on Thai cinema history. Welcome to the show, Mary.
Thank you, Gake. I'm very happy to be here.
Welcome, Mary. Mary's my colleague at the University of Nottingham in Malaysia. It's really great to have you on the show because, as you know, Pima, a very popular film, Thai film, was just playing in the cinemas recently in KL.
Yes, it's done extremely well, both in Malaysia, in Thailand itself, and around the world. And it's currently, I think, pretty much the highest grossing Thai film internationally, although that's difficult to confirm at this stage.
Why is it so popular? I mean, this is a story that's been told and retold many, many times.
Well, I think a lot of it has to do with the director, Ban Chong, himself. I think he's a very experienced, excellent director who has a background in making horror movies. The vast majority of films he's made have been horror before. So I think we're talking about a movie that is of very high quality. I also think as well that it does, to a certain extent, drift outside its national boundaries. So I don't think it says to me automatically that this is a Thai movie, as much as, say, the 1999 Nonsi Nimabucha version would say that very much, which is all about sort of Thai identity and the landscape and foregrounding Nang Nak or Mer Nak or Pimak, as she's often called, as being a specifically kind of Thai myth or Thai discourse. But I think that this version is one that's accessible to people much more worldwide. I also think, as well as its director and its accessibility, that it's riding on the reputation of Thai film as being specifically good and enjoyable when it comes to ghost movies. We've had a lot of very successful and high-grossing Thai ghost movies that have done well in Southeast Asia. For instance, I'm thinking movies like Shutter, which even though it was made almost 10 years ago, is still very much a part of people's consciousness here. All of my students talk to me about Shutter when we see when we talk about Thai movies and Thai horror movies, and even Asian horror movies as a whole, I think. And again, remember that that was Ban Chong's debut movie. At the time it was released, again, it was one of the highest grossing Thai films ever internationally, certainly the highest grossing horror at the time. So this is what Ban Chong is building on. So I don't think that this success is of any surprise, really.
I mean, you compare it and say that it's kind of more contemporary. And from what I read, it was also, you know, it has a more contemporary feel because it's making these references to pop culture today, you know, to the movies that everybody watches that, also happen to be global Hollywood films.
Yeah, I think, I mean, right now, it is often difficult to compare, say, movies that will be made in a small national industry that may not have so many resources to sort of global, huge American or Indian movies. But I almost feel that we can do that to an extent with Thai film. It's very well funded at the moment. The directors are getting increasingly more sophisticated in the techniques that they use and the resources that they have at their disposal. So I think Thai film is competing quite well, actually, with Hollywood, which is unusual for a small and Southeast Asian film industry.
Because the production quality is quite high. I mean, oftentimes Malaysian filmmakers talk about that, you know, that, that their neighbours to the north actually have very good quality, high-quality films.
I think we also have to take into account there that Thai film automatically has a huge audience. People do like Thai film. This wasn't always the case before 1999 1997 or around the late 90s when we had this resurgence of Thai film.
Right.
Before then, and even into the sort of early 2000s, people would say, "Oh no, Thai film's no good. No, it's it's what the maids will watch. It's what the lower class people
will watch."
And this
is among Thais themselves?
Yes, very much, which was quite surprising for a country that prides itself on sort of quite, well, it has a high degree of nationalistic pride, shall we say, amongst people. So I was very, very surprised and quite shocked, actually, when I heard of these negative views that people held within Thailand towards their own film industry. However, this is something that has changed now very much.
But this, I mean, partly that comes out of this sort of numb now or sticky water, stinky
now,
water films, right?
Stagnant water. Yes. This was a phrase coined, which was a very condescending phrase, I find, because really it was one that was imbued with a sort of almost, you could say, a discrimination towards lower class Thais, people from the northeast, people from the north, okay, who would come to Bangkok and work as maids or work on as driving taxis and construction, all that. And people would say generally, as a way of distinguishing themselves from these people, that, oh no, we watch sophisticated foreign productions, we don't watch these sort of lower class movies. But actually, I think that these movies were always very sophisticated. They were very well in tune to what people desired, and they were very, very successful. I don't think these
are... When were they made?
Well, we're talking really, when we talk about this cinema that we refer to as Nam Now, as being sort of around the mid to late 1950s until around, shall we say, the 1970s, all right? And this was when what we had, which was called the 60mm era, was very fashionable, and this was aimed at lower class people. It was actually a silent form of film that was made very cheaply and very quickly on 16mm film, and it was dubbed in cinemas by live dubbers, which I think is an absolutely fascinating example of how film can be adapted towards a specific cultural requirements or a specific situation there. I think it's a lovely example of this diversity around the world. Then we see sort of a gradual kind of phasing out of 16mm film when really a synchronized 35mm film was introduced more in the 1970s, and a film called Tone was produced in the 1970 itself, which was a film that was hugely successful and kind of moved away from catering for kind of the old people and provincial audiences and started actually addressing the kind of new and jazzy, very Americanized Thai youth that had come out of American influences, which had come into Thailand as a means during the Vietnam War. So after the 1970s, this audience tended to switch somewhat. In the 1980s, what we see is the teen era. The teen era was kind of movies that tended to be about teenagers. They tended to play for Thai youths in large cinemas. And they also tended to be something which again was looked down upon by sort of mainstream Thai people, shall we say, all right? Tended to be something where you said, oh, these are just kind of trashy movies that teenagers are watching. But actually, this was a very important part in the actual growth of Thai film to eventually become the industry it is today after 1997, because this laid the groundwork, and particularly for the exhibition industry. These cinemas that were started to become large, started to attract lots of Thai youth there, actually laid the basis of which, out of which, the post-1997 new Thai industry was going to grow. These were what sort of pulled Thai people back into cinemas to an extent and showed that Thai cinema could be a profitable industry.
But the number of films also shrank, right? From 1978, you had, you know, during this crazy period of cult or action, cheap action films, you know, you had 150 films being made in 1 year alone, and then it kind of shrank to, in the 90s, maybe just 10 a year or so?
Sure, sure. I mean, during the 80s, really, you had a large amount of these teen kind of movies being produced. Then, yes, that shrank to an extent in the 90s, but really a lot of these movies became higher quality films to an extent, all right? So I think what we have is a concentration of resources rather than what we'd see as an industry that is kind of going downhill rapidly.
But was it, what did all those people, where did they go? I mean, did they just go to TV and cable? because there's also kind of the growth that TV was always a challenge. TV was always a competition for the film market.
Yes, it's also or difficult. Video. Yeah, I mean, it's also difficult as well to actually come out with some really accurate stats as to how many people are going to cinema at this time, because remember also that travelling cinemas in provincial areas were also very, very popular, and we don't really have any stats as to how many were operating and how many people were coming to watch these at all. I mean, this all changed in 1997 with the introduction of a film called Deng Burley and the Young Gangsters. This was a film really that proved that Thai cinema could be enormously profitable, and it also started to get people other than teenagers into the cinemas. It was a film that was concerned not only with kind of teenage life, but also with nostalgia for a previous era. Because it was set in, I think it was around the 1950s. So it was set in this era, and this tapped into a sort of degree of, or a desire for nostalgia for viewers at this time, and older viewers, not just teenagers. This movie then demonstrated that Thai film could be something that was incredibly popular and opened up cinemas that beforehand had been these kind of exclusive den of iniquity where teenagers would go to sort of to hang out, and paved the way for a movie such as Nang Nat in 1999 to be released to a general Thai audience, and that of course did extremely well, as we know.
I mean, but a lot of the the films that came out during the rebirth of the Thai Renaissance, if you like, was very much tied to nostalgia, right?
Very much,
and
very
part
much.
Of it,
yes.
Part of it was driven by patriotism and a sense of let's look inward and see, you know, where we are because of the financial crisis, right?
Absolutely, they are very much tied, I would say, to sort of discourses after the financial crisis. They've been called sort of return to the past films or heritage films. And we're talking about ones in particular like Nang Nak, of course, in 1999, and also Surya Thai, released in 2001, which at the time was an enormous undertaking, and was, again, the highest grossing Thai film for a very long time.
Well, there are reasons for that.
there are many.
Particularly when you have, you know, schools are all kind of, you know, bust in to watch it. So you've got, you know, group tickets going. You know, it's, we're talking about people who are going as groups rather than...
Certainly. And it's a movie that sort of has almost remained within kind of Thai psyche or Thai consciousness for a very, very long time since. And its Western release also did particularly well as well. I mean, it's a very nice movie to look at, I think. It's very pretty. And
it's a bit too long.
It's extremely long. Well, you should see what my students say when I make them sit through it. But movies such as Surya Thai and also films such as The Overture as well, all of these. Fan Chan was another one that did very, very well. All of these are about going back into Thai history and really kind of questioning what is it that makes us Thai. And also coming out with this, I would call it quite reactionary in a way, this sort of unity of we are Thailand and we are Thai and we are all together. And of course, is fitted with discourses in society after 1997, because a lot of what was promoted by Thai rulers was this: we've got to get back to basics, all right, and we've got to find who we really are. And the figure in particular of the rural peasant became this figure that was embodied with this sort of
Monrack transistor.
That sort of thing, which was, although Monrack transistor, I would say, is a little bit different because I think it was very much, much more progressive in its discourses there. But certainly, we do see a lot of going back to this almost idealized situation of the rural peasant. We see that a lot in the 1999 version of Nang Nak, for instance.
But I mean, the reason for, you know, nostalgia is always about the disillusionment with the present or the direction that you're heading, isn't it? I mean, if we watch, what is it? It's not 69, it's Fun Bar Karaoke.
Oh, one Fun of Bar these. Karaoke, yes.
So Penek, how do you pronounce his last name?
Penek Ratanarang.
Ratanarang. And these three first films that he made, 69, Fun Bar Karaoke, what was the third one? Before Last Life in the Universe, right? And they all had to do with a sense that in one of them, her father is a gambler and she's trying to basically save him from debt. You know, so it's this sense that people were going a bit they were really, you know, very capitalist. People were investing in the stock market, and then when the market crashed, they felt like it was karma, I suppose, that, you know, it was kind of revenge.
Yeah.
And these films started to get, you know, to be more critical about capitalism and things like that.
Certainly, certainly. I mean, we can identify quite a few discourses, such as the ones you've outlined, and those that I would say are more reactionary, such as the heritage films as well. I mean, generally, when we talk about the economic crisis there, we say, well, the people who really did the damage here, of course, were inevitably never held to account, really. And the people who suffered the most were obviously the poor people. And I think a genre that engages with that particularly well is, of course, horror. And I almost feel that horror provides us with almost a relief to an extent to a lot of the nostalgia, this kind of sugar-coated nostalgia to an extent of the heritage films there. I like very much that I find that movies such as Shutter, for instance, critique this to an extent, I feel, and they say that there's something not right in society, and maybe there's something not right with the kind of the attitudes that we've held towards lower class people, towards women, maybe towards ethnic minorities there. And what we see in horror movies, inevitably, as we see around the world, as horror is a nice as a genre that allows us to critique society in particular ways, is this idea of people coming back and taking their revenge a lot. We often see a lot of wronged women or a lot of people from outside the cities being angry about their situation, and often for justified reasons in Thai horror movies.
But can I ask though, I mean, there are, from my knowledge, there are kind of two types of horror. The kind of art cinema, experimental filmmaker who makes these sort of gestures towards the ghostly or the haunted, but not actually produce horror in the way that we know it. And I think I find them more circumspect because it makes us, it's not the shock horror that you know gives us that immediate satisfaction, and we don't really think about it much more. You know, your Uncle Boonmi, who recalls his past lives.
Syndromes in a Century is another one. Yes, definitely.
You know, like in Uncle Boonmi, Uncle Boonmi recalls, you know, that he had killed communists. So there's a sense of looking back and thinking, you know, maybe those things that I did cannot be justified as I'm facing death, or, you know, how do I reconcile with that? And the kinds of horror films that we get in the cinemas and outside of Thailand that play in the US and here, they're not political, are they? I mean, they can't be read as political, can they?
Well, I would say that all films are political, given that they're a product of a system that is inherently political in so many ways. But I think one aspect that you've actually picked up on there is interesting as regards audiences, because I'm quite interested in Thai audiences, and I'm interested in how the Thai viewing audience is segregated by particular kind of ethnic and class boundaries. So you will have certain people watching some movies and certain people not watching others, and certain people choosing to watch these ones. And these tend to also be quite different to the movies that are successful internationally at the same time. I think Pitchapong is very interesting as a case study of that, given that his sort of success within Thailand came largely from a sort of upper class type audience here, showing at festivals worldwide. And this is not a comment on his movies, which are excellent, which are fascinating. But as ironically, as he's become more successful internationally, in particular in Cannes, etc., he's become more noticed and more successful within Thailand itself, So I find that interesting for various reasons. I mean, in one level, it's almost like he's become more Thai in the sense that he's been embraced internationally as such. But at the same time, his movies actually have an astoundingly close link back to the discourses of these lower class films that were showed in the immediate post-war era. I think all of his cinematography, his editing, and even his mise-en-scene to an extent as well, is very, very close to that. And I feel he's paying homage to the movies that are dismissed as being kind of low quality and just for poor people, for instance. And I find that's quite ironic, that by embracing these, he's been seen as more Thai internationally. And then simultaneously, his embracing internationally as Thai has led to his increase in popularity within Thailand. So I think there are a lot of issues to talk about when we try to divide films in by their discourses, by what they're trying to do, by the way in which we could classify them as horror or as not horror, or maybe as suspense or as art, for instance. These boundaries really start to break down when we start talking about them within a specific cultural context. But I think, again, we're talking about cultural specificity here. It's difficult to define genre when we start crossing borders that have language, that have their own viewing practices, that have their own different kinds of cinema and film style techniques.
You say that, you know, going back to the beginning, we were saying that there's now more money to invest in these films that are increasingly popular. But I suppose if we were to take a more film aesthetic or strict film approach, we would say, oh, but they're just turning out the same formulas over and over again. You know, how many phobias and how many shudders and how many saws can we take? Not that, you know, Saw comes out from Thailand.
But,
you know, somebody like Api Chapong, he's got an international reputation, so he's able to source funding, and he sources funding from different types of projects, you know, whether it's exhibition in museums and whatnot. But what about other filmmakers, you know, not Ban Chong, but, I mean, isn't it still difficult to make the kinds of films that don't conform to particular genres and formulas?
I sort of feel, I mean, going back to your comment about are we sort of turning out the same thing to an extent, I don't have a real problem with that, in the extent that as long as people are churning out something that is successful and people are enjoying, then I say, why not? I mean, I have to say, when I was told that another version of PMAC was coming out, I just went, oh, not again. Because there are so many previous versions, and I couldn't believe they were making another one, and I expected it to disappear instantly, and how wrong I was proven. It's been incredibly successful and is an excellent film. So I don't see a problem in sort of remaking all of these sort of Dracula equivalent kind of figures again and again. And I find it very interesting when we see these new versions coming out, many of which are new filmmakers who have a different take on this. So I would say a film industry that is particularly buoyant is playing to its strengths well. Having said that, though, it does seem to be quite difficult to make it in this regard. And we do seem to see the same names coming up again, the same directors in particular coming up again and again and again. But having said that, if these guys weren't good, then this wouldn't be happening, I don't think.
That's all the time we have today. If you miss any part of this episode, please head over to bfm.my to download the podcast. This has been Reeling Southeast Asia, bringing you on a journey to discover Southeast Asian cinema right here on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.